That's it. It'll just run happily away, and I'll put another one somewhere else.
Yeah.
Just in case.
Is there anything else I can do for you? Really?
It's just a wee bit dark here, but...
You want me to get them to put some lights on or something? Are you okay up here?
Well, I'll put my glasses on, it should be okay.
Okay, I'll get a hold of Will and see if you can put a light on. You just need a light, Rebecca. Right, just a single spot on Stuart.
If it's too much problem, don't worry.
Get Robert to get us a light that way. Yes. It's not crushingly crucial, but it would be excellent if you could do it.
Good. So how are you, Andrew?
I'm very good, Stuart. I've been busy with good things. I haven't been up to Aberdeen.
No?
You know, I usually go up there and do a couple of sessions.
Oh, yeah, because you've been working with life sciences.
Aye, yeah, absolutely. So I had it in my head that the next time I came up, I would give you a ring.
Just a buzz, yeah.
But I've not been up. They sometimes ask me in February, you know, it's usually the kind of time that I go. Usually they get me in to kind of fill the students' heads full of alternatives before they get the civil servants in, essentially. So the civil servants.
Yeah.
I've got your tougher time. And I'm off to India at the end of going for a week.
Where to?
To Delhi. To work with one of our members, a guy called Rajiv Kumar, who runs a think tank, an economic think tank, basically. And he spoke in this series as well a couple of series ago, and he's been posted now for about 3 years, and what he says is that he's tripled the size of the staff, number of staff, he's quadrupled the budget. And so that's kind of working really quite well. What's in it? Okay, so that gives us a bit of space now to do the real work of sort of what we're going to do in the future, kind of thing. So we're going to give them a bit of a hand.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, it should be quite good. It should be quite good. And I'm hoping that Graham is going to come and Malcolm in there.
Mm-hmm.
Malcolm's going to come there in Glasgow today, meeting about education. So they're going to
pop along.
Mosey over after. So the kind of way that it goes is that Julia will kind of introduce you.
Yeah,
and you speak for a lecture length of time, however much that is, and then usually like we don't have to start bang on time, but usually kind of come a wee bit late. But I do like to finish in time, so that people know when they come.
Yeah, well, roughly I'm going to speak for about 45 minutes.
Perfect. That's perfect. That's perfect. I'm real looking forward to doing that. So.
Oh well.
Yeah, this is a time machine. And then that gives us plenty of time for questions.
What would you spawn the lights?
Just a light, you know, Stuart's going to speak from here, so just kind of like, can illuminate that kind of area so that you can
read that.
Yeah, it'll basically be all the lights, there's no, right. You can't individually put them on, I'll show you.
Okay, show you. Let's have a look and see what it's like. It'll wash that out. That's too much.
It's okay, I'll struggle along with this.
Is that too much, yeah?
That's too much, yeah. Don't worry about it.
That's great, thanks for trying.
No problem.
Okay. Should have brought my miner's helmet with me.
I wonder if they could do something.
No, no, I've got my reading glasses on, I'll be fine. And once the colour things come, I'll be
all right. Yeah, you'll be all right. I don't want to make a song and dance about it, but.
That's.
Don't worry.
No, don't worry.
You don't have a wee lectern light or anything?
I don't
like that,
know. I know I don't, I was just thinking that myself.
Yeah, that'd be a good thing, isn't it?
To get up and turn
manually. Yeah, no, don't worry about it. Don't worry.
I'm just learning myself to start doing a torch.
That's fine.
Unless you want to move it forward.
That's up to you. You're the man.
Can you move it forward?
I can do that.
Yeah, let's move it forward a wee bit.
Would you rather have it down here?
No, if I move it.
Just a bit forward.
Take
the tape a little bit.
Hold that a second. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Stick that in your arm.
Should get a good wax while you're here as well.
Right. There's a second one.
Here's one I made out.
Right there.
Okay.
Push yourself for that. You just want to grab the front there.
Right.
Yeah, just slowly.
Into the light.
That's a lot
better.
Okay, guys.
Okay.
Hey, let's get this back down.
Great.
Thank you.
And that must be live, isn't it?
That is, yeah. Right, well, that is, you've got a lapel mic, so you can wander about,
John. No, I'll
you're okay, just stand
here, yeah.
Okay. And then, Julia, I'll introduce you using this handheld, and then we'll use the handheld for roving for questions.
Very good. So something happening tomorrow morning, Andrew, is
that
right?
Yes,
I've got to go to
the hospital. Okay, thanks. I talked about this later on. There's people from the centre who work quite closely with the centre. Usually quite close to us, so it's kind of what the lecture's about. So it'll be a dozen or so people. And there's no additional preparation for you, but it's just like, okay, 5 minutes, so what was you saying, what are the implications
okay,
of that?
Yeah.
And then kind of have more of a discussion kind of session. And we'll just see where we go with it, you know, like leave it kind of open. And it's just like that kind of thing, and then we'll stop about 12-ish, a bit before, if you need to stop before. We usually have sandwiches and stuff, so we'll have a bite to eat before we head off.
Well, what time is it now, Andrew? Sorry.
What time is it now?
No, what time is the thing tomorrow?
9:30.
Oh, 9:30, that's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'll be able to get away at lunchtime.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, we can get away, you just tell me we're away.
Yeah, I'll come in with Jonathan Clark.
Oh, great. What time?
Just after 12, so
that's okay, fine. That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's
great.
Like you've got time.
I know, absolutely not.
Do you want to give them back later, or are you happy just to...
It's just a standard...
The way that we do it, Stuart, is there's a copy that you sign back to us, and a copy for you, and it's what's called, it's a Creative Commons...
Commons license, yeah.
And it's attribution non-commercial. So whenever anybody uses it, they've got to say you're the author, and we're not allowed to use it for commercial purposes, not for education. It's basically it. That's the golden degree. If you go just one page behind, there's those kind of three.
Yeah, it's a standard thing.
Credit to you, not commercial.
Yeah. Oh, I can sign just now.
That's great. Thank and then you can take one away. I've got a folder I'll give to you.
Sorry, I didn't realise that was so slanted.
Okay.
Didn't realise it's so slanted.
Yeah, that's your one.
That's
your pen.
That's fine, thank you.
Stick it in there, so there's a wee pack of stuff for you.
Well, great.
So that's the people who are coming tomorrow, just some centre stuff. Some GoWell stuff. I don't know if you know about the GoWell programme.
No.
Well, it's... there's some people from GoWell there tomorrow, but essentially it's a kind of let's follow the housing programme, see what impact there is in health. And then a kind of wee a visual thing. Have you seen this?
No.
Jennifer Williams said it's a kind of visual report from our civic conversation.
No, right, good. Good.
I think you might quite like that.
Excellent. So how's Jennifer?
She's very good. She's off to India as well. She's going to work on a leper colony for a couple of weeks.
Interesting.
Yeah, she's doing really well. And you know, the kind of visual report, we're just about to send them all out actually. So if you need more, or if you think anybody else can ask them, that'll be fine. But she's
a good concern. We do quite a bit with health and, you know. I brought, I don't know if you've seen these, Andrew. Edited these six booklets.
Oh, yeah, somebody gave me them. I'll tell you who it was.
Julia?
Oh, no, it wasn't. It was Stephanie. Young.
Have another set,
I will. Thanks. Because I gave one or two of them away. Right away. This is, did you
edited
these?
Yeah,
brilliant. So it's packed. I don't know. Okay, I'll look, I have seen these. Brilliant. Is that the whole set?
So there should be six.
There's six.
Huh? Yeah.
That's brilliant. Thanks. I'll look forward to this. Who's John Thacker like? Oh, I met him one time. You got to dinner or something.
Yeah, he's absolutely fine. We had him in Aberdeen, we had him for dinner, it was great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's quite a well-known guy, but he keeps emailing me saying, how's the little white paper going down, you know? I said, fine. I'm not going to know. He's done a lot of work in India.
I noticed that with the doors of reception.
Doors of reception in Mumbai and Bangalore and so on.
That's right, because they had a route near just before we went in 2006, I think. Let's see. It's really good for me to be going back after such a long time. So, we'll see what we want to do later. I think Julia and Don might be up for going for something to eat. And you're staying here, aren't you?
Yeah.
So we could eat here as well if you're leaving. Here, would you rather eat somewhere else?
I'm not bothered, Andrew, at all. I don't know what happened there, but...
Okay. Uh-oh. The last text on you. It's probably asking for a password next time. There we go. If it does that, just
do you know what to do?
Yeah.
Neither have you. Yes, I do. Yeah. I thought you were going to come and sort out the technology. So how are you?
I'm very well, and you?
Good, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Fantastic. So you're doing stuff with the CCA, or?
No, I'm doing stuff with the hospitals in Glasgow at the moment. I'm managing with our commission going into the new
Victoria.
And with at those hospital schemes, the lead artist is Thomas Clark, poet, and then the Victoria scheme is one of the Glasgow artists. And Ali Wallace and so on. And I'm doing some work with the schools program as well.
Great.
Keeping busy, and I've got the hope it's a good fit for some more artists as leader work. So that's all good news.
Yeah, you heard Andrew, you got a big bid.
Well, no, I know. That was it was the result was, getting an A+.
Yeah, but this is what's happening, because.
No, but it counts for a lot to me anyway. To know that you're right up there.
Yeah.
We'll resubmit it, and we should. With a bit of luck, we can just.
But it's because of this new priority, because I'm on the peer review college, and this has just come out, so you can get a great score, but then you've got to rank them. Mm-hmm. And then someone else then decides on the incredible HRC priorities.
But in a sense, how do those priorities articulate?
Well, that then what happens is I get Sian's proposal or something like it, and I rate it, I give it a top. Mm-hmm. Top rank, and then it goes to a ranking panel who then say, we agree with the kind of rigour of it in terms of research, but it's going to be put in this priority list relative to, so it goes 1, 2, 3, 4.
Yeah, and what are those priorities?
Well, they'll be put against AHRC priorities, whether they are
internationalism or
it's economic impact, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but obviously the trick is to make it be sharper about those, so we'll try and just put in a few keywords.
It's also because the money's got less, it's just fine.
But yes, no, it seemed to me that
the jam is
going to
be thin.
Yes. If somebody suggested that take it to the Economic Social Science Research Council, there might be more money there.
Maybe. They have a completely different system.
No, I know. I'm sorry. I wasn't being serious.
I think that it's a serious proposition. Someone has also said they shouldn't be saying this, but not if it's obscure, but if it's an obscure kind of archive project, that probably stands a better chance.
Dundee seem to have demonstrated that quite effectively, don't they?
I've seen a few like that. Don't have the expertise to
do that. No, I know, and we've been talking about one actually, which would fit into that category as well.
No.
Well, there you go. See, that's the answer. Obscure archive project. You don't know about it, therefore it must be important.
It must be serious.
No, he's been at the forefront of connecting up people in particular different states who were working on getting practices through the 90s. He did his PhD on the public art regeneration in the late 80s and brought together people like Suzanne Lacey and Platton and actually the impact within the practice of his little network and what he's doing was enormous, and actually it's a very documented control, and it would be heavily useful to get that. In the same way that DeMarco, he knows it exists, but nobody knows what it is.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a different.
But they've changed them very well.
Yes, very well. Yes, you want to get in there. Absolutely. No, it was a bit of a blow. Particularly to get a very good rating for no money. I mean, you do get left with the cerebral, like, well, what do we do?
Yeah.
What are you meant to do? But the people, we've got a lot of people in the network are very supportive. So we have to be applying. It's interesting, somebody else said, you know, there's a trick of that actually, like in the urgency. They said something about the others. And I'm sure I think they made reference to what it was to do with presumably third RPLP in Iraq, where it was like, if we don't do it now, it's going to
be. I saw that.
And there's a sense of, if you've got the credibility, you can add a level of urgency that there that actually becomes, it's like, oh, you can't say no to that. You know, if people are and they're going to do the work really well, they can say no to that.
Exactly. No, I saw that actually.
Oh, still, we're not going to talk about it.
No, so it was confidential. That's what those are.
I've got to sit down and let you get your mind around this.
Gerard,
go on.
Right, okay, here's my question, right? Part of this discussion, we go to this public safety reform.
Absolutely.
Right, okay. That's
not being my answer, don't.
Is that fine? Is that the one
you're
talking
about? Putting in, Julie?
Yes. You booked, apparently.
Yeah, but they'll never turn up. But mind you, that's quite good as it is.
There's a few from the lighthouse coming. Oh, there they are. Gwen and Joe from ULS sitting on the.
Oh, yeah, I see them, yeah. The only two who are left.
Well, yeah, about three of us.
So, did you say to me Emma had got her job, Julie?
Yeah,
she has,
she'd been offered it. I spoke to her the day after, and she was trying to speak to them about conditions. I guess they wanted a full time in Edinburgh, but it sounded quite a nice job.
So, oh yeah, no, I think I wrote the reference and had the job description and all that stuff, so it looked pretty good. Yeah,
she said they were a nice bunch of people.
Yeah. Have you seen those jobs with this thing in England, the successor to Creative Partnerships?
Yeah.
It's called CEE.
They're in London, aren't they? Education jobs.
Yeah, they are in London, yeah.
I did see them and I made a note because I thought they sounded really interesting.
Yeah, they are in London, yeah. The bugbear.
Put me right off.
Yeah.
Anyway. Are you okay? I'm going to do a kind of just a very short introduction.
and then at the end I thought I would pick up questions.
Yeah,
something maybe about news.
About?
News in the long term, you know, the sort of long term.
Oh, right, okay.
It's been a piece.
Yeah. As a legacy, yeah. Yeah, it's quite funny seeing all that stuff on TV.
Yeah, did you see it?
No, Catherine saw that. I saw it. It was repeated on BBC. Not repeated, but they did a bit of it on the news the next night.
Oh, right, yeah, I didn't see that.
It was a clip kind of thing.
Lots of the stuff again that you
did. Yeah, it was quite bad. Because I forgot it was 10 years ago. However, I managed to weave that into the...
Oh, well done. That's good.
So yeah. Did it make sense when you read it? Yeah?
Yeah, it did. Yeah. Have you changed it much since?
I've added bits to it actually, but because you don't know, it's meant to be a bit of health, so, and oh, you don't know how many kind of architects have built the value of the so it's kind of wavers about a bit.
But it's got, from what I saw, it's quite a mix.
Yeah, but from that thing Don and I were at this morning, all the talk is about design and innovation, about public services, so...
Uh-huh.
I think more or less I'm on the right line. So.
Well, I think there'll be lots of people from
that public bit, yeah.
Yeah. That sounds good.
And I like to get my bit in about being a child's garden as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's a good story.
Yeah. So. I was told off about that being on TV.
Really? Who? The man himself?
No. Well, he's our chancellor.
Oh, that's right. I really told you that. So, what in the nursing home? Don't upset the chancellor.
Well, very indirectly, you know, like. Circles, you know, people talking on television.
Policy is present,
isn't it? Is that
sad? Oh, it's
quite exciting. Well, no, but it's just, well, I'm going to ask one guy, this is people, you know, playing roughshod over the plans or something, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
How they're getting away with it, yeah.
It's really cool. I'm genius.
Oh, yeah, totally, yeah. What happened before Christmas was Peacock still needed to get the money flowing in from all the funders because if that hadn't happened, everything would have dried up and they had to pay off the design team and the project would have just died.
Wow.
Peacock probably would have died because it's important to, you know, hundreds of thousands paying for this, but I kind of last minute meeting of the council, they agreed to keep funding it until March. £600,000 would be needed for 3 months. You know, it's £200,000 a month for the project, you know. Well, that's because the council did all the public funding, it was held by the council. And at one point, the start of this, I should have said, was they were said, oh, because of this, you know, good thing, we can't release the money because that wouldn't be politically, you know, legal. And then they changed
the project just
falls. Yeah, so it lives for a couple of months at least. But the hope is then we get some momentum going. You know, these came up just a day or anyway, so. Well, of course, present climate is not affordable anyway. Buy all that concrete. Something the council standard costs 180 quid a just to do concrete. Look at Star.
George Sloan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. Right, yeah, why do you want a great thing, a massive square for Milton?
Because he drives me crazy.
Andrew, is that the microphone that I have to use?
Oh, yes, that's good. That's just a microphone. What's up? It's 5 minutes.
Okay, I'll switch it off.
Yeah, you just push the button back in.
that one.
Yeah, no, it's a wee button. You can do it. It was just feel fit next to the red light.
All right, so just press it.
Just press it in. That's it. That's it. Just push it in. You'll get it. Do you, you can have this one if you want.
No.
Got it? You got me.
And how far away do you hold it? You just took it out.
Yeah. I don't know. I would say, I'll stand in the back of the room, and if I can hold it a bit, I would say, probably about that.
Okay, so it's not
that. No, it's not letting me. A lot of BBC Mason commenting around, coming up in the outside of the studio, and they're like, what's that about it?
I'm really used to practice with a hairbrush. Right, I'll get off the stage.
No, I'm just going to leave this off now, Stuart, until we start.
Oh, no,
it keeps dropping it because of the tight pitch. We've got the chair on the headboard, and
see.
You see? It's the best thing I've done there, Andy Lynch.
No,
then Andy Lynch, the chief executive of the Scottish Air Force, is also going on. Amidst the great thing. I can see how we're being turned down. Give it another 5 minutes.
Sure.
I think I'll intro from up here.
Yeah.
Good so work. Is that on?
Mm-hmm. That's on. Yeah.
Shall I stand back? Sorry, standing back over.
So you're not going to use that torch there?
I think if that's on, I'll just use
that. Yeah, best bet. Come this way here. Yeah, it's the first time I've been here. The hotel's not bad, it's only about 3 rooms or something. It's £50 a night. So it's bad for a double, so I don't know where to come now. Yeah. And you think in the morning, because it's not really a hotel, you make your own way down, breakfast is like a story, anything in bars. Yeah, you go in and out from the side door, which must be... That's good. Yeah? No, can't see Alan. No.
Okay, so the floor's starting to sort of bend off me, so I think you can just start whenever you want, and I'll drink it one if people come late.
Yeah.
Okay. Break a leg or whatever it is one says in these circumstances.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Julia Fenby, and I am Deputy Director of the Lighthouse Scotland Centre for Architecture and Design. I'm delighted to welcome you here this afternoon for this lecture on Talking Cities with Stuart MacDonald. This, I'm told, is the third in the fifth series of lectures organised by Glasgow Centre for Population Health. It's a particular pleasure for me to introduce Stuart this afternoon because we worked together for over 8.5 years when Stuart was the first director of the Lighthouse. When Stuart appointed me in the early days as education manager, he sent me a letter saying, welcome to the most exciting cultural project in Europe. And he was so right, it really was, and continues to be. Stuart laid the foundations for what has become a really amazing centre in Glasgow, which puts education at its heart, and it's all about engaging people in the built and designed environment. Stuart is now head of Gray School of Art in Aberdeen, and he continues to be a major player in advocating the importance of architecture and design in Scotland. From its outset, the Lighthouse aimed to engage people in talking about architecture, design and the city. And it's always been based on the firm belief that architecture and design are interconnected social, cultural and political concerns that affect everybody and that everybody has a right to be involved in. We promote and celebrate Scotland's architecture and design, and we bring the best examples of international practice to Scotland. We believe, as I say, that everyone has a right to high quality architecture and designed environments, and through our work we engage people from across all sectors, schools, communities, public and private sectors and professionals, aiming to engage people in debate, empower them and to equip them with the skills that they need to become more involved in making changes to their environments. The context that we're working in has changed considerably since we opened in 1999. For a start, Scotland's policy on architecture, which was launched shortly after we opened, is now almost 10 years old, firmly embedded, and it's supported programmes on things like public engagement, sustainable design, improvement of our school design and protection of Scotland's built heritage. There's the government are revising planning policy. The Architecture and Design Scotland body has been established to advocate for good quality built environments. We have city design champions. We have the curriculum for excellence in our schools. And there's also a widening awareness that well-designed environments have a hugely beneficial effect on our health and well-being and on our capacity to work and learn. So all of this together with, as the flyer for this lecture said, together with the media coverage on design and architecture and popular TV programmes such as Grand Designs mean that it does seem that everyone is talking about our cities. But I think what Stuart's going to explore is, are people talking enough? Are we doing enough? Are the right people involved in the debate about our built environments? And what more can we do to make them better? So I'd like now to introduce Stuart.
Okay. Thanks very much, Julia, and thanks very much to the Centre for inviting me, and thank you all for coming. When Andrew invited me to do this talk, he said you can talk about what you like, so more or less I am going to talk about things that interest me to do with cities and the built environment, but hopefully by the time I come to the end I'll be able to round it up and make some sense for you, hopefully. So, talking about talking cities, I don't know if you saw at the weekend the film Slumdog Millionaire, Danny Boyle's movie about how someone can take control of and transcend their environment. In this case, the hero Salim, who wins a TV game show and can leave the teeming slums of Mumbai. Apart from being a brilliant movie, the film makes a fascinating connection with architecture and cities. In the closing sequence of the film, in what is a really interesting piece of symbolism, and I couldn't get a bit from the film that shows this, so you just have to make do with an image of the railway station in Mumbai. And what's a really interesting piece of symbolism, Salim, having become a millionaire, sits at the base of the statue of Frederick Stevens, the architect of Mumbai's amazing Indian Gothic railway terminal. What's even more interesting is that in the frame, all you see is the statue's base and the inscription, Frederick Stevens, architect. Salim then at last comes together with the girl of his dreams, who he's going to take out of prostitution, and the station then erupts into a Bollywood dance routine. If you look at Twitter and other blogs since the weekend, people have been asking about that sequence with the architect's statue and what it's all about. I'm no film critic, but I think that the sequence with the actor sitting at the foot of Stephen's statue says more about architecture and our aspiration for the good life than a million words, and it's very relevant to what I've been asked to talk about. But I suppose, just to wax philosophical for about half a second, you can blame Aristotle for setting in motion the Western philosophical debate about the kind of connection between citizenship, civic value, and the public realm. about the balance between public and private, if you like. And over 2,000 years later, that public-private relationship, far less partnership, is still unbalanced, and the debate is very much alive. Given that I'm talking in the context of the Centre for Population Health, I suppose that the relationship between health and the built environment began in earnest with the architectural expression of the post-war liberal consensus. This was the solid equivalent of the National Health Service, if you like. New towns, high-rise blocks, concrete city centres, peripheral housing estates. In fact, all the things that many people now see as the opposite of the good life. Places like Cumbernauld, now in its sixth decade, once seen as the answer to the post-war housing shortage, are now seen by many people as failures. One of the reasons for that is that post-war planning treated people as a homogenous, undifferentiated group, all with the same socio-cultural needs and interests. So in this talk, I'm going to look at impediments to the good life, the effect of an inhospitable built environment, the impact of bad design as a way of looking at inclusion. And because the impact of a designed environment upon us is huge, I will suggest that everyone should be talking cities as a fundamental part of democracy in the same way that we talk about health or education. Of course, in one sense, we do talk cities. Everyone, it seems, from Kevin MacLeod to Prince Charles is talking cities. What makes an eco town or city? What is sustainable design? What about architecture and happiness? Do you like Prince Charles's Poundbury? And if you don't, you can have the Wayne Hemingway trendy, wimpy version of Poundbury. However, what we don't talk about enough in this context is inclusiveness, equality and diversity, and what they mean in the public environment. In fact, even when we do talk about this stuff, we do so in a way that alienates 99% of the population. That is the majority who don't have a degree in architecture, design or planning. So I am all for a new colloquialism, for developing a more straightforward narrative about the environment that admits a wider constituency and the people who matter. Helpfully, placemaking, the new term on the block, is generally agreed to be central to social inclusion as well as our cultural well-being and identity. But what does make a good place or space? Crucial to understanding that question is that people experience their environment in different ways depending on their social, cultural and economic circumstances. Politics and policies can enable good spaces, but they can also be exclusive. If all citizens are to be comfortable in and identify with the spaces and places they inhabit, then the full diversity of their experience has to be considered. So as well as talking about cities in a more convivial way, it means adopting a more human-centred design approach, and the language of design thinking and co-design has to come out of its professional ghetto to be expanded and normalised to become a prerequisite of civic life, tools of citizenship, if you like. In talking cities, therefore, I'm really talking about the shared public realm, not just public spaces, parks, streets and neighbourhoods, but also public services, schools, health centres, libraries, social spaces, or living democratic spaces, as Arich Tawney put it. Talking about the public realm in this broad way is useful, I think, because, as well as admitting a fuller range of architectural possibilities, it is more than the sum of private interests and must serve people with different needs, backgrounds and interests equally and simultaneously. Firstly, just to make a topical point that architecture, politics and the public realm are interconnected, I want to refer to a couple of projects, one in Aberdeen, where I'm now based, and another in New York. Union Terrace Gardens, which you can see in the image here, is a one-hectare park located right in the heart of Aberdeen, to one side of Union Street, off the city's main thoroughfare. It's a natural amphitheatre and used for occasional concerts and leisure activities, as well as providing an oasis for relaxation in the city centre. It's also a haven for young people in a very young people unfriendly city. On the north side, and this is a view of the north side, is a floral crest depicting the city's coat of arms, and at the Union Street end, there's a mature group of elm trees, which are approximately 200 years old. Numerous attempts have been made over the recent past to change this space, including a large-scale Millennium funding bid, but all have been unsuccessful, and each has been accompanied by controversy. Nonetheless, despite the protectiveness felt in Aberdeen about the gardens, a radical new building has been proposed on this site. The new building, designed by international architects Brissac Gonzalez for Peacock Visual Arts, will be situated on three step terraces within the gardens. This setting, coupled with a strict requirement that no building obstruct the view to His Majesty's theatre, which you saw in that image, from Union Street, gives rise to a unique architectural condition in that the building is literally entered from the top down via the roof that will also serve as an expansive urban space. On the roof, there will be a host of different ephemeral activities, market, bookstalls, exhibitions, cafe. These activities will attract visitors to the gardens and the new building. They will hopefully enrich urban life along Union Terrace and also serve as a living signage of sorts for Peacock Visual Arts, an organisation which has a track record of working with disenfranchised groups throughout the city, including beggars and the unemployed, sometimes to the displeasure of the City Council. Amazingly, despite the radical nature of its design, it seems gradually to have won the hearts of Aberdonians. However, on the 11th hour of Armistice Day, in an interesting bit of symbolism, Aberdeen entrepreneur Sir Ian Wood announced that he would gift £50 million of his own cash to create a new city centre heart for Aberdeen by decking over Union Terrace Gardens. This has raised even more controversy, not least its potential impact on the delivery of the new Peacock Arts Centre. The new centre will provide Aberdeen with a much-needed cultural hub targeted upon all ages, and many believe, myself included, provide an even more necessary platform for creativity and innovation and an incubator for young talent. In its present form, Brissac Gonzalez's design for the centre is incompatible with Serene's vision, despite its having received planning permission, achieved all of its £9 million public sector funding, and been given the land from the council. The scale of what is being suggested by Serene for Aberdeen, which is for the most part a low-rise city, is huge, and Aberdeen already suffers from dislocations of scale. And the emerging Union Square, for example, sits uncomfortably within the city's topography. Decking over the gardens would create a 5 to 6 acre space comparable with Red Square in Moscow and larger than most of the great European squares such as St Peter's or the Piazza Navona in Rome, Trafalgar Square in London or Piazza San Marco in Venice. And those squares relate to large or dense urban populations. In comparison, Aberdeen and its hinterland has a population of only 400,000. Could that number from a very dispersed geographical area animate a space on the scale of Red Square in Moscow? Of course, something as imaginatively ambitious as Chicago's Millennium Park, with its Frank Gehry outdoor auditorium and Anish Kapoor sculpture, might just pull in the crowds. But Aberdeen is not Chicago. In fact, Aberdeen is not Venice or Rome either, for that matter. It has its very own identity, and trying to manufacture an outdoor cafe culture, something that always seems to surface in proposals for European-style public spaces, for Aberdeen with its bracing climate, is also debatable, far less 5 acres of it. You cannot superimpose an urban culture on such a distinctively northern city. Aberdeen's unique granite architecture and typology require a different, more sustainable response, and the answer is more likely to be found in Scandinavia than the Mediterranean. Of course, as well as a large new civic square, Serene's vision would also create a large underground shopping mall and associated parking. But what is really interesting about this intervention and makes it more than a local quarrel is the way in which a rich businessman can hijack the planning process and interpose his vision. What is even more interesting is that Serene has said that he needs public support behind his scheme, and how that support is to be informed and gathered is, of course, the question. In New York, Olafur Eliasson, his Tate Modern What Weather project attracted 2 million visitors. Olafur Eliasson's waterfalls, which you can see in the image, was clearly intended to provide Mayor Michael Bloomberg with yet another public art blockbuster. Ushered in by an enthusiastic waterfront news conference, Bloomberg proclaimed it the most unexpected and intriguing waterfall destination between Niagara Falls and Victoria Falls. For Bloomberg, waterfalls, which extends from Midtown to Governor's Island, represented $55 million of tourist income and, I quote, a beautiful symbol of the energy returning to our city. In reality, Bloomberg's public art project deals a very aggressive pro-development assault on what were once mixed-use working-class neighbourhoods, part of the largest reshaping of New York's built environment since the 60s. In his book From Welfare State to Real Estate, Regime Change in New York City, 1974 to the present, Kim Moody describes the profound socio-economic shift that resulted from the near financial catastrophe of the 70s. Moody refers to a crisis regime which, through emergency measures, served to shift the balance of power between government and unions in favour of a newly formed business elite. It began with Giuliani selling off community gardens, amongst other public assets, and has continued with Bloomberg's privatisation of Union Square Park. Indeed, Bloomberg's cultural philanthropy has disguised the billions of dollars in tax breaks awarded to developers by the city at the expense of its citizens. For hungry New York property developers, the city's waterfront is a new frontier, and many areas of Brooklyn and Queens have been rezoned for major development. The city's biggest developer, Forest City Ratner, and its largest construction company, Tishman, who are the major sponsors of Eliason's waterfalls, are using what is called eminent domain to seize private property in Brooklyn for one of the largest urban developments anywhere, including plans by star architect Frank Gehry. In Eliason, an artist who is accepted by the cultural establishment, Bloomberg has secured, in the words of one New York critic, the ideal candidate to join his campaign to pacify New York, while running roughshod over communities in preference for the needs of luxury developers. Given the financial recession, you would have thought that we had learned lessons about the commodification of the private realm. However, the key question, whether you're a New Yorker or an Aberdonian, is how do you get into this debate and how can you affect change? What skills and capabilities do you need and how do you get them and who do you get them from? There is, however, a radical emerging field of practice that responds to the changing social landscape and resists the narrow and confrontational way in which architecture, design, art and city planning are often discussed. At a philosophical level, Ian Borden, who's Professor of Architecture at the Bartlett, has provided us with 13 tactics for the good life, for a new kind of urban space that is diametrically opposite to the space of professionals, drawings, geometry, static objects, and urban management. The last three, active health, active thinking, and emotions, are germane to the work of the Centre for Population Health. But he argues for a public realm in which the public can order and reorder and organise activities in a much more flexible way that would give a totally different construction to public space. At a practical level, here in Scotland, as Julia has alluded to, this has been spearheaded by the Lighthouse's Access to Architecture programme, which is a delivery component of the Scottish Government's policy on architecture and which has involved thousands of participants in projects across Scotland. Not least, it has initiated numerous Scotland-wide projects focused on enabling local communities in partnership with built environment practitioners to take greater control of their immediate environment. This new form of practice is gathering worldwide momentum, and to cite just one example, it's clearly delineated in the appropriately called Design and Landscape for People, Claire Cumberledge and Lucy Musgrave's useful attempt to bridge the disconnected worlds of planning, politics and commerce. It does this by exploring the ground underneath the centre of local conflicts and is very relevant to the current debacle in Aberdeen about the future of Union Terrace Gardens. Their approach is marked by an awareness of symbolic value and the significance of meaning within place. There are three aspects to this: a belief in the effectiveness of the small action, an emphasis on local distinctiveness and values, and an interdisciplinary approach, the latter demonstrating that regeneration is not just a job for planners and architects. And to those three aspects, I would add a fourth: transformation design, an approach in which design thinking and co-design are core, and in which the stakeholders are considered as integral to the process, and no stakeholder is regarded as more important than any other. What I want to do is link transformation and design thinking and co-design, that approach, to the policy context. Firstly, in the context of creating a more inclusive approach to design, the Commission on Architecture and the Built Environment, CABE, in England, has set out five high priorities, including doing more than you need to, exceeding regulatory responsibility. Consult local people, building a track record of engagement and listening. And importantly, use imaginative methods of involvement. Use plain language and promote environmental equality and cohesive, sustainable communities. The key in those five priorities, I believe, is how you innovate in imaginative ways of engagement. Second, in building our legacy, the statement on Scotland's architecture policy 2007, Scottish ministers have indicated their wish, and I quote, to enable the people of Scotland to be involved in decisions which affect them and which impact upon their built environment. To support this aim, they wish to ensure that people have both the opportunities and the necessary skills to participate actively. They believe that community involvement can significantly benefit the quality of design outcomes, as the people that have a connection with or will use a building can provide important knowledge about how it can and should be used. Scottish ministers also believe in modernising our planning system to promote early and broad-based engagement in the formulation of planning policy and decision-making, because they believe that community engagement in the built environment needs to happen at the earliest stage possible, and it has to be meaningful. In many senses, none of this is new, and a lot of work, certainly in countering exclusion, has been done by a wide range of organisations like the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, Changing Places, the Stephen Lawrence Charitable Trust, and the Women's Design Service, to quote a few. And the problems of urban regeneration have been extensively analysed and critiqued, for example, very recently by John Houghton and Anne Powers in Jigsaw Cities, which used Birmingham as an example. The difficulty with this area is, I believe, that it has not kept up with the really radical developments in design thinking, in education, and in service delivery. There is a transformation going on in those areas that could dramatically alter our approach and secure what the Scottish Government and others concerned with this area appear to wish for. Wikipedia, in its definition of design thinking, describes design as a transformation of existing conditions into preferred ones. Design thinking is then usefully linked to an improved future. At the same time, the term is being used to define a way of thinking that produces transformative innovation or an emphatic people-led approach to problem-solving. Again, however, there is nothing particularly new in all of this. The thinking processes of designers have been the subject of study for over two decades. Also, the fuzzy front end of human-centred design has been developing rapidly since before the end of the 20th century. Likewise, movements that encourage participation early in the front end, largely because this is seen as necessary to drive human-centred product development. The latter movement has also prioritised creativity as a means of involving end users early in the development process, whilst evolving strategies such as co-design and emphasising the need for tools to take this forward. In this context, customers have evolved into users and users into co-designers. What has not happened is a wholesale transfer of this strategy to solving problems, including exclusion, in the public realm. Design thinking is also, to use Ian Borden's term, active thinking, and you could contend, a prerequisite of a healthy mind. More recently, and much more prominently, the Design Council's Red Team identified a new community of practice that was building on traditional design skills to address social and economic issues, and which used the design process to enable a wide range of disciplines and stakeholders to collaborate in what it termed transformation design. When the Red Team's director, Hilary Cottam, was awarded the title Designer of the Year by the Design Museum in London for her work in applying design thinking to social problems like prisons, schools and health, there was an uproar in the design industry because she was not a designer. Nonetheless, what that successfully opened up was a debate about the contemporary role of design and the need for a wider recognition of how it was changing, namely, who was now doing the designing, or more appropriately, who was doing the design thinking. Apart from underlining the effectiveness of the interdisciplinary approach that is so central to transformation design, the Red Team also set out some challenges for designers in terms of the need to apply design thinking in broader social, economic and political contexts, to collaborate fruitfully with other disciplines and champion human-centred design. The red team no longer exists, but Cotham has picked up her own challenges and moved on to setting up Participle, a new social venture to design the next generation of public services, working with Charles Leadbeater and others. The issue is not really whether transformation design signals an extension of traditional design skills or a departure into a new discipline. The point is, it offers an authentic way of actively engaging people in transforming their own environment, as it can integrate specialist knowledge about one area with a broader understanding of several others. In the commercial world, this recognition has been further enhanced with a range of new technologies to promote innovation. If only they could be refocused upon the issues of the public realm. Nonetheless, elements of what I'm setting out were rehearsed, and Julia again has alluded to this, when I was the Lighthouse's director, and taken forward by the Lighthouse's education and access to architecture teams. Within each, the components of transformation design, design thinking, co-designing, cross-disciplinarity were located within an educational approach that did not discriminate between stakeholders. And by way of illustration, I'll just take four case studies, and this is very apposite, given this is the 10th anniversary of Glasgow, UK City of Architecture and Design, 1999, and people are now asking what the legacy of Glasgow 99 was, and I think it's something to do with these case studies. The Cranhill Water Tower project had its origins in the education programme for Glasgow in 1999. What happened was a group of local people from Cranhill came to the Glasgow 99 team asking if something could be done with the water tower to improve their environment. That simple request kicked off one of the most interesting public art programmes, I think, ever, with local people, including kids, working with architects and designers to produce a really transformative design that, as well as changing attitudes to place, attracted a nationwide publicity to an area not accustomed to receiving a positive press. It became a model for other parts of the city and further afield, as well as becoming the inspiration for an innovative online education programme, part of a suite of web-based tools within the Real Lifelong Learning project based here in Glasgow. A few years ago, again instigated locally, this time by the local enterprise agency, the Lighthouse, its national programme and education team, with Girvan Horizons and Sutherland Hussey Architects, carried out a series of workshops and consultations with the Girvan community to produce a regeneration proposal for the town. The focus was on raising awareness and aspirations for the future of the predominant seafront in this coastal area of Ayrshire. The proposal was aimed not only at a regeneration that benefits the local community, but also about ideas of tourism and the socio-economic aspects of Girvan. Generated from the Sutherland Hussey proposal, the second workshop aimed to achieve work that was beneficial and complementary to the regeneration project. A member of the Lighthouse education team worked with Girvan Academy to explore the town in terms of visitor experience and signage. The initial regeneration proposal led to a more detailed study, which was used to help secure funding to take forward the proposal. What's interesting about this project is that it offers a process for any town that wishes to raise awareness and has aspirations for its own future. Picture This, Plan That was an early Lighthouse exhibition just after 1999 that sought to democratise architecture and was based on the work of randomly selected Glasgow residents. Citizens were sent a pack consisting of disposable cameras and information sheets, cultural probes, asking them what it is about Glasgow that made them feel that this was a place they wanted to live. They were asked to look at the good and bad things in their environment. And indeed some of the packages actually came back. The ones that came back, the research aimed to assist the City Council in making planning decisions for the redevelopment of city sites, provide developers with new guidelines for the construction of infill buildings in the city, and develop new guidelines for architects when they design buildings. Importantly, it was also innovating a new mode of consultation. The returned images and information were curated into an exhibition, which you see in the image, which, as well as educating about the city, also served as a very authentic backdrop for debate. It was also an early example of non-professionals becoming co-curators of their own environment. Field Trip was an exhibition in a series of shows dedicated to opening up Scottish architecture to a wide audience. It was also a part of a development which increasingly delegated responsibility for the exhibition's curatorship to non-professionals. The curatorial idea was that a number of groups would take 5 routes across Scotland. Passing through highland, island and central landscapes, the routes connected points of architectural interest along the way. To gather responses to these routes, 5 groups led by 5 guides went on field trips to record the journey, examining the landscapes, buildings and structures that they passed or encountered. The guides were responsible for the approach taken to the field trip and each set a brief for their group. In addition to the brief, each person was given a notebook and camera and asked to buy a souvenir, collect a memento and send a postcard. The combination of the guide, the group and the brief resulted in different interpretations of the journey, different views of Scotland, if you like. All of this material was then harvested and curated into the exhibition. Thus, the participants became the exhibition's researchers and, in a sense, its co-curators. The field trip methodology is eminently transferable to city centre, housing, estate, neighbourhood field trips. So, as well as forcing a rethink of how, when and where we learn, all of the 4 projects from the legacy of 1999 illustrate design thinking and co-design whilst providing a context for a range of convivial tools. Site-based workshops with practitioners and non-practitioners, digital web-based tools, interdisciplinarity, professionals working with community or amenity groups, co-curation, cultural probes, field trips. You can find similar lists to this on community planning websites, some much, much more extensive than this one. The element that is missing from them, though, is that of transformation design, which Cotton and others characterise in 6 ways: defining and redefining the brief, collaborating between disciplines, employing participatory design techniques, building capacity, not dependency, designing beyond traditional boundaries, and creating fundamental change. So, you have systems thinking coupled with designing for socially progressive ends. So while lots of lists exist, what needs to be done is to gather these techniques, approaches and methods into a comprehensive toolkit, a very practical way of tackling problems, and in the process offer a mechanism for enlarging the public franchise. There are many other projects, especially education projects, that I can draw on from the Lighthouse Archive. But I hope that you've got the point. There's a lot of expertise in this area, much of it centred in Glasgow, as well as the Lighthouse. There's extensive experience in the city's housing associations, but we need to do much, much more in terms of policy and practice. It appears that to secure the good life means embracing the idea of the shared public realm, those living democratic spaces in which environmental equality and promoting environmental quality and building cohesive sustainable communities are the outstanding priorities. Consultation is, of course, key, but it means going beyond so-called good practice and really taking on board imaginative ways of engagement. We need to do far more than we need to. In addition to building on our back record of engagement and listening and using plain language, we have to keep up with radical developments in transformation design and service design. In that sense, involving design thinking and co-design to create a toolkit for citizenship and well-being are prerequisites. We need to pull all those resources together to create what is called in the science world upstream engagement. I have a list of things we could be doing. Reviewing all the tools available to create a comprehensive toolkit to enable effective engagement, whether within the public realm, community planning, or as users in the procurement of a new building or space. Exploiting the opportunities within the new curriculum for excellence to make design and the built environment experiences an integral part of mainstream education. Set up broad-based access groups for all major schemes and provide them with training. Encourage all design professionals with a role in the public realm to see themselves as public educators or public servants. Promote the idea that democracy in the public realm is not a referendum or some witless poll, but a process that can accommodate dispute, media scrutiny and change. In the public realm, we need to know more about what public really means in terms of diversity and capability. We've got a long way to go to secure inclusivity, cohesiveness and sustainability in the public realm in our cities. In the present climate in which a new deal that's been put on the table, it seems that we have an unequaled opportunity to connect policy with practice and to inject a major investment in creativity and innovation into the public realm. In the same way that Roosevelt's call to arms in the 30s New Deal held out opportunities for artists to help overtake his pioneering aesthetic civic vision, the new New Deal could provide hundreds of creative practitioners with the chance to be involved with transformational projects, whether they be infrastructural, social, civic, heritage, conservationist, or to do with green energy. For starters, the National Health Service could do with a major injection of creative, transformative design thinking. A major new creative capacity could be built to transform the public realm, promote well-being, and protect us against the vagaries of the market. And who knows, 1,000 new social ventures and enterprises might also flower. We need to ask ourselves different questions and find different ways of responding to them. And there are many more strategies and tactics than I have covered here. I want to end with a couple of images that approach the public realm in quite different ways. This is Timorous Beasties, the Glasgow-based textile company's dystopian view of Glasgow camouflaged as a 19th century idyll. I prefer to think of it as a comment on the commodification of the public realm. And of course, there are other, much more subversive ways of engaging with the public realm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stuart. We're going to open things up for questions and discussion now, but perhaps I can pick out a few key points that I've noted down from that. It was a very interesting, fascinating lecture with an awful lot in it. Some of the things that I picked out were we need to think about the public realm as being more than just public spaces. It's about the services and infrastructure that we all use, which makes it a truly democratic sense of the public realm. We need to move towards a point where everyone thinks about having a good built environment as being a right, in the same way that we talk about education and health being our rights. Very interesting stories about what's happening in New York and Aberdeen in terms of the politics around urban development. Design needing to be more person-centred, drawing out local distinctiveness and values, and working on interdisciplinary teams where all stakeholders are equal. We need to think about using imaginative ways of engaging with people, in making sure that we engage communities early on in the design process. And very interesting stuff about transformation design and, of course, developing toolkits for citizenship and connecting policy with practice. Maybe if I start out with a question. There's a very apt, interesting project about to start in Neilston, a small town in East Renfrewshire, that's going to be launched on Thursday this week. It's the beginning of a programme called the Renaissance Towns Initiative, which is about regenerating small towns across Scotland. And what I wanted to ask you about, Stuart, is that Neilston has been, if you like, the community there has been thinking about regeneration for 5 years with the aid of a local champion. And it's been very much a ground-up process, a slow burn, as Pauline Gallagher describes it, who's been working with those people. So they're now at the position where they want to work with professional architects and designers to look at their environment and their services to improve it. It's not being imposed upon them. They now have the tools to work with those professionals. Do you think that those sort of approaches that work so well in that small community can be translated to cities, which are so much bigger and more complex?
The quick answer is yes, I think they can. And it goes back to the point I was trying to make about Lucy Musgrave and Claire Cumbridge's book, that one of the points they're making about the importance of the small action. And I think what Pauline Gallagher's doing in Neilston, working with the local community, working from the ground up, and the importance of skills which are embedded in that project and empowering local people to take control of their own environment is eminently transferable to wider, larger projects. All you need to do is just expand the training, expand the enabling, and expand the thinking, and just do a bit of design thinking, I think, in order to make it work.
Thank you. We now invite questions from the floor. We've had a couple of people with microphones, so if you could put your hand up and say who you are, that would help. Thank you.
Or a place anywhere, if you like. But just to take the example of Glasgow, I think one of the barriers in terms of the health service and public health, but it's equal, it's applicable to other public services, if you like. I think the first main barrier is designers or the design community themselves or itself, who up till now have not explained, you know, the kind of the importance or the applications or the effectiveness of design probably as clearly as they might. And I think you know, kind of sea change has to happen there, but it is happening in order that people understand, you know, just how useful design could be to them. I think we need more case studies of successful design involvement in places like the National Health Service, you know, working with users, working with doctors, working with nurses. The Red Team, who I mentioned in the presentation and the talk, produced some very interesting case study material working with health services down south, which I still think is very useful, and indeed working with patients in terms of improving their own well-being using design thinking and co-design. But I think we need more of that kind of broad base of resources to convince people. But I think also we need champions, and in the health service, I think just as in cities here in Glasgow, we have a design champion. I think in the health service, you need design champions to get design taken on board, because there are lots of things you can see in the health service. You walk into any hospital, and all the design challenges meet you at the front door, quite literally, in terms of signage, interfaces, communication, mobility, etc., etc. Lots and lots of challenges there, all of which could be resolved by effective design thinking. So lots of things we could be doing. Education is also important. We need to train young designers to work in service design and to be sympathetic to working in public services, including the health services. We need more placements for students while they're at universities, so they get experience of working in the health sector, and we're doing that in my university and my art school. But we need to make designers better able to communicate with people about what they're doing and what they're about, and we also need design champions, and we need more case studies and better communications as people understand the impact of design in terms of social context, if you like, if that answers your question. But you know, could be Glasgow, it could be anywhere. The problems and the issues in the public sector that are waiting for designers are endless.
Andy Mill from the Scottish Urban Regeneration Forum. Thank you very much for the lecture. I thought there was a lot of very interesting stuff in it. I was struck particularly by some of your references to New York and the broader political context. It made me think of some of the passages in Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, which she talks about the ways in which public resources are captured for the benefit of elites. And that sort of makes me think also about the way that SURF as an organisation, its members look at regeneration. That is regeneration in the context of degeneration. We don't operate in a vacuum. and a lot of the activities which are described as regeneration are quite frankly property development in a hyper-consumerist context, and in fact often result in the degeneration of real communities. So given that we don't take our work in a vacuum, as it were, and the climate around us has changed so much and so radically in recent months, and we're dealing in a recession, a very deep and long recession that's going to bring a whole range of challenges for us, it may be that it also presents a window of opportunity for some significant change. And I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on the way in which designers and architects in particular might play into revitalising some new solutions for genuine regeneration in this change context.
Yeah, no, I think that's you've set the context pretty well. I think it's very interesting that we're pretty going into a deep recession. You can either be very gloomy or you can be optimistic. I prefer to be optimistic. And I think it presents us with, as I was trying to say at the end there, a really major opportunity. If you're looking at the kind of the way the government are talking about investing public money in infrastructure projects, but for design professionals, for emerging talent from art schools, for young architects, for creative professionals and graduates of all sorts, to get involved with the public realm and add value to what's going on in the public realm. But I also think that should be an important part of their courses. I mean, traditionally, design students, including architects, the context for them has been getting a job with a big corporate, with a big practice, with a big company. But I think that kind of mentality, if you like, has to change, and more we have to educate emerging talent and emerging designers to think about how they work in the public realm and how they work with people. And I think the recession is a perfect time to innovate, if you like. I was at an event in Edinburgh this morning talking about how do you innovate in a recession, and all the talk of is how do you inject talent into the public realm, whether it's redundant executives from big corporates, and how you recycle their talent. But for me, given that I work in academia, my big concern is how do you find interesting, engaging work for the kind of design talents emerging from our art schools and design courses. And I think what's happening just now is a major, major opportunity. There's so much that can be done in the public realm, in housing, in crime, transport, health, education. The opportunities are unbridled, and I think it could spawn a whole new generation of social enterprises, if you like, that we haven't even thought about. I keep going back to the central issue of skills and how you enable people to pick up those skills that can make them perform and function in the public realm. Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point, Angus, and I think we do need more very strong advocacy with funding bodies to recognise the importance of, if you do want something to be genuinely innovative and creative, then it's going to take on board a large degree of risk, and how that's handled is really important. It applies not only to arts and design projects, but you know, all sorts of major grant applications where you're expected to spell out all the kind of risk assessment beforehand, and the exit strategy and the outcomes and all the rest of it. I think it's to do with the change of mentality, if you like, to be much more accepting of risk, and to know that you can handle risk, and to be accepting of failure in a sense as well. I mean, what our systems at the minute don't recognise and don't embody is the capacity to absorb failure and how you deal with failure before you get onto the issue of risk management. But I think that, you know, some major advocacy needs to be done with public funding bodies, and going back to the point about the public realm, given the kind of recession we're in, and if you do want change to happen, then change is not going to be possible without being accompanied by a certain amount of risk, and therefore by a certain amount of failure, and how do you manage to cope with that in the kind of public context. In a business world, it's all perfectly acceptable. Failure is accepted as a part of risk if you're innovating. So it's a kind of change mentality.
Yeah, I might have an idea. It's a fascinating talk. I have to pick up that last bit where you say that it may seem that we haven't got here with the experience of failure that the public and the private sector have had. It's a shame that we're not able to deal with it. But what I wanted you to speak specifically about how the idea of the design thinking can be implemented in a kind of time period which would allow us to both look at the change environment that Andy Noll was talking about in terms of the creative crunch and the recession, but also the issues of climate change. And the fact that, unfortunately, our track record of learning lessons and moving forward is so poor. If you know, especially in a field like regeneration, that you know the sort of neoliberalism ideas, the things we were talking about happening in New York, and how the very subtle elements of public realm being undermined time and time again, and the UK being a kind of hinterland or kind of European resistance to that, but actually more for the kind of the wage into Europe. About undermining the idea of the public realm. How can we, within a time scale which equates to what I would say is the unshifting thing of the cultural, of the climate change, that is something that we cannot put off indefinitely. We have to be changing that, is, you know, we had to be changing way 10 years ago. But talking about it over the next 5 years, what could groups like this, and this is the design thinking process, this is the range of people from different areas, what can groups like this do within the next 12 to 24 months to see that design thinking start to have impact?
Yeah, if you put that question to the audience, because it's I think up to them to answer, I think. I think it's a very absent question, and how do you, because there is an emergency, or a crisis, if you like, certainly in terms of sustainability and dealing with climate change, and how we can change things quickly and effectively through design thinking. I think agencies like Participal, the Design Council, for example, are now starting to get much more into this issue and advocating with the government to try and bring about a change in a much quicker turnaround, if you like. But how you engage the broader public in that debate and then connect them with the political community to affect real change in a fast timescale, I'm not quite sure. But perhaps this is the kind of the way of doing it. The mechanism is to do it through groups like this. I mean, already, for example, the government seem to be slowing down, or at least changing their mind, or considering changing their mind about the other runway at Heathrow, for example. And that's been because of wider advocacy from all sorts of people, including the science community and the design community as well. So there is a kind of wider awareness happening, but to get it done in the kind of timescale you're talking about, because some of it is quite important, it's done within the next in the immediate term, I think, is quite difficult. What I was talking about in the talk, of course, is a kind of slightly longer term cultural change through education, where people can actually take on the debate and feel confident in engaging with professionals as co-equals to look at some of the kind of major issues of the day. I think what you're talking about would need something quite radical to make it happen in the kind of time scale we need. But I don't know, other people may have the answers, you know. Absolutely. I think you know, in terms of the structures, the education system, whether it's higher education or the school system, takes ages to evolve and change and you know, bring forward new curricula which are relevant for the times, and usually by the time they do it, they're out of date. That obviously has to change. But I think what we can do and what we don't have in this country, but they have in Finland, for example, and other parts of Europe, are intermediary agencies which draw together people from different disciplines and which by and large use a design thinking approach, although they might call it something else, to tackle the kind of major issues of the day, whether it be health, education, climate change or whatever. But I think there are signs of that. Certainly the conference I was at this morning, which was organised by NESTA, the National Foundation for Science, Technology and the Arts, which was supported by the Scottish Government, there seems to be a lot of recognition that you need these kind of intermediary agencies to take on board these kind of matters of the moment that big clumsy structures like universities or the education system just takes far too long to get to grips with, if you like. Sorry, I didn't quite catch the end of the question.
The question was basically, to what extent is it all about carrot, or to what extent is it about stick? To what extent are there ways in which legislation should be forcing designers to, and developers to actually take action on some of the points you made?
Well, I think I'd answer that question by saying, I think part of the problem, if you like, whether it's to do with carrot or stick, is to do with planning. And the way that we construe planning, if you like, which is a kind of very alienating process, you know, doesn't allow for people to enter at the appropriate points. And I think we've got to deconstruct planning, if you like, and allow for a kind of wider constituency of people to get a toehold in the planning process, you know, whether that's through some of the initiatives I was talking about or whatever. But I think talking about in terms of carrot and stick isn't really the kind of way forward, actually. I think our problem is the way we construe of planning, or the way that planning is construed of in this country, with its heavy emphasis on control, if you like, And that has to change, I think, is slowly changing, slowly from the kind of ground up.
Hello, Margaret Thomas is my own community psychology. I wanted to pick up what Mark was saying there about time. I've been very interested in what you're saying, not least because I worked to be both an architect and work in the health service, and then I ended up in the second and still being in the first. What I'm thinking about is time and the amount of time that it takes to work with communities. The example that I think is very close to here, I don't know whether there's anybody in the audience involved in the canal waterway development that's just up the hill along the road here. Well, you've got a few communities that are being developed radically by mothers that are moving into the quay up the road here, onto Rough Hill and up to Mary Hill. How do you work with communities that have lost trust with the waves upon waves of change and people consulting them in token gestures? I've listened and went to some meetings up here, and these are not token gestures, but the difficulty when you have 1 year to try and reach different people. You do arts projects with children and adults, and that's lovely to get together, but how do you get those voices heard? I grew up just at George's Cross here, moved up, got my middle class voice, my professional shoulders. I can stand up in a meeting like this with yourselves, but there are many people who cannot have that voice. So not all the voices who are being invited by the toolkit are going to have equal power. I'm wondering about that, and I think time has to be built into this. And maybe the idea, as you said, of actually some of this economic slowdown, perhaps we can do much more constructively. Be very interested in what you think.
Yeah, I think obviously each community project or project is different, and some projects, because of the, who's involved in them, will necessarily take longer than others. But I think the key point you're asking there is how do you engage with people and how do you give them a sense of ownership and a sense of involvement and participation. And I think the answer is certainly in terms of the legacy of Glasgow 99 and the Lighthouse and beyond that in Glasgow, there are lots of different methods, techniques, tools that have a proven track record in doing exactly what you suggest. So you're going to...
My cousin's quote is that when you have a new hammer, everything looks like a nail. The tools perhaps are not the metaphor or the toolkit, and I know what you're meaning by using it. I believe this bunch seem to have a very good set of tools. I think it's more dynamic than that, more organic, and more about trust than necessarily strategies.
Sure, I think you have to take let's chuck toolkits to the side then. I think you have to take an empathetic, experiential learning approach to working with people in the community, recognising them as individuals, and starting from where they're at, if you like, and that will necessarily take a long time. And the process has to be an educational one of, and building up the kind of relationship between teacher and learner, in a sense. But I also think there are some projects that can have a very quick turnaround. I mean, the Lighthouse has got lots of experience of working with young people in the design of new schools, which in a matter of weeks or months you can bring young people who've never really engaged in the design process up to speed very quickly, and then you're able within a matter of weeks to take on board quite sophisticated discussions with architects. And in some cases, and this is a kind of legacy of these projects with new schools, actually influencing the design and making quite significant changes. So I think different approaches here for different communities are needed. But I was using toolkit as a kind of catch-all term. But I think for different communities, a much more different, deeper educational kind of process is involved. And obviously, you need people who are sympathetic to working in that kind of genre as well.
Hello, right. James Arthur from Glasgow City Council. Made a comment when you're answering the other questions about the kind of impact of design and the social context. I'd like to develop on that field a little bit, really. Just what do you mean by the impact of design? How do you measure it? Is it something that can be measured? Or is it something that just happens and people adapt accordingly? What do you understand by social context? Is it through social class, is it through family and kinship networks, or is it something through inside or outside the networks? These are all quite difficult concepts for people who are quite close to that to grasp, and to try and think that that can be summarised and handed on to a couple of sections in an architecture degree is, I think, quite a difficult concept to try and grasp. So just like to get a better idea of how you think those two things can be developed.
Well, I agree with your latter point. It would be a very difficult thing to grasp in a couple of sessions, and quite the wrong way to go about it, if you like. But to answer the kind of central part of your question there, how do I define a social context? I was coming to that by making a contrast with the commercial context. Most design education, certainly in art schools and design schools, up till now has largely been focused on training designers to work in industry or work in commerce. In other words, to get a job with a practice or a company designing, let's call it some kind of widget or some kind of product that eventually is going to be marketed and distributed and sold. So that has a certain kind of orientation, there are certain skills and methodologies embedded in that kind of education, if you like. By contrast, I was then talking about social context, which might mean working with a health organisation trying to improve the interface between, say, nurses and the public, or are trying to improve the environment of a health building, for example, or working with the police. And I'll give you an example that some of my own digital design students are working on at the moment, working with the police, who are working with disenfranchised young people in housing estates in Aberdeen, trying to get them to be more socially responsible, and the students are working on designing a digital game that brings them together, creates a social networking site, gets them talking, thinking about crime, responsibility, and so on. So just as by contrast, that's what I mean by a social context. And largely the context is defined by the group itself. The other important thing you mentioned there was about metrics or evaluation. How do you judge the success of it? And I think certainly in this country and in the sector I now work in, we're obsessed with metrics and results. And we're saddled with that system. You can, of course, create metrics for this kind of thing if you want, but I don't think that's really important. I think the real success is in, for example, the project I'm talking about is where the young people actually come, they're engaged, they're interested, they keep coming back, they work. You can see from their engagement that they're interested, that they've learned something, and they want to go on and do other things as well. So there are lots of ways of measuring success, if you like, in this kind of social context. I think also, and the Design Council website, which you've probably looked at, has got lots of this stuff, you know, looking at the work of the Council's Red Team, and Hilary Cotton was its director, working in social context in prisons and health, and what the kind of metrics were for success, usually prescribed by the funder, for example, but nonetheless, there are quite some serious evidence-based outcomes used to judge the success of it, in exactly the same way you would judge the kind of success of some business growth scheme or whatever. Sorry, I can't hear you.
We're on the middle of the story that we're about to tell about transitional design within NHS socialising and applied. But what I really want to pick up on is the carrot and stick comment that was made earlier. We embarked on forming working groups and involving staff in two new hospital bills, the Sod Hill Victoria in 2005. I think it wasn't until the Architecture and Design Scotland and Health Department letter came through the stick to the Health Board to actually pull together a design action plan, but really NHS Works Glasgow and Club really got its act together around traditional design, and we're involved in lots of things at the moment, and pockets of innovation and stories to tell. And so I think that stick really helped, and I think there's a lot of staff now and people within NHS Glasgow and Club and patients are really looking forward to some with the use of new environments.
Yeah.
Andrew Roberts, Trade Glasgow and Applied NHS. Do you want me to use this?
Okay, that's very good, thanks. I'm very happy to come in behind Jackie, because there really has been, I think, a very encouraging development of engagement and involvement of user groups in the NHS design. That wasn't really what I wanted to ask you about or tell you about. What I wanted to ask you to expand on was your reference to housing associations as part of the store experience in Glasgow. Now, there are quite a number of people in this audience who have been involved in working with community-based housing association movement, which was pretty innovative in Glasgow, going back to the 1970s. I'm very conscious that working with housing associations, you're working with a sort of consistent community of interest, whereas if you're working with health, it's a much more transient level of interest. The patients come and go. And I just wonder if you could expand a little bit about what you think we should be drawing from the community-based housing association movement, how that has been the involvement in design, what the outcomes have been, and how transferable they are to other areas.
Okay, I think Reedvale and Gorbals, just to take two examples, are kind of shining lights in what I was talking about, and you have got a long track record now of user engagement that's actually brought about not just the effect of engagement, you know, which is self-evident, but actually resulted in really interesting architecture as well, and placemaking, and it's self-evidently so, if you like. You can go there and you can see it, and you can touch it, and you can smell it, and experience it. Certainly when I was at Lighthouse and before, and all the experience in working at Glasgow 99, talking to people in Gorbals and Reedvale was that you got that very clear sense of purpose, if you like, that people were definitely engaged. In fact, I almost came to believe that was the norm, and I went to other places, and of course it's not the case. That in fact you recognise that that experience in Glasgow, I mean, it's not unique, but it's almost unique, if you like. And I don't know much about how housing associations, you know, gather together and harvest knowledge and then disseminate it and share it. You know, I'm talking like a kind of educational professional now, but I think probably my guess is that there should be much more of that kind of, in a professional sense, gathering that experience together, the lessons of that engagement, what were the bits of success, what were the methodologies, the processes, and presented in such a way that it could be shared and disseminated to other similar groups, if you like. So I think they're models, in a sense, and I'm quite sure in saying that, and I'm sure the two directors of those housing associations would say exactly the same thing, that they are models for the rest of the country and elsewhere.
Today there's some controversy in the media from the universities worrying about what they see as the possible subordination of curriculums to what's called the pursuit of sustainable economic growth. And I know as a board member of the Cities and State in Glasgow, this has been something of a great concern in the arts and the culture fields in Scotland over the past couple of years, again with subordination to the pursuit of sustainable economic growth. Reading the framework for addressing poverty in Scotland from the Scottish Government just a few days ago, and actually the first line in that is the pursuit of sustainable economic growth. If that's what public policy is going to be all about just now, you see a locus of what locus we see in that with regard to design in the public realm, particularly in the urban areas?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, and the Scottish university sector was named by the Minister the other day as the seventh element in sustainable economic growth, and indeed it may be, but I think the crisis we're in, the economic recession we're in, should surely engineer a change of thinking, if you like. That's, of course, we want sustainable economic growth, but the whole of public policy, should not just be focused solely on that. There's important other things that we're you know, about the development of civic life and about the development of people as individuals and of individuals within a group and within society, they're hugely important. And certainly in my own sector, there has been a tendency to kind of overemphasise the importance of employability and economic growth as opposed to the development of individuals and their place in society. But I think there might be a rebalancing now enforced on us because of present circumstances, if you like. But I think engagement with an expanded public realm in the kind of ways I'm talking about could be part of that process, which is quite compatible at the same time with an emphasis on sustainable economic growth. The two are not incompatible, if you like. And certainly in terms of the education world, I think those two things are eminently, you know, they can be eminently coupled together. But I think, as I was saying, the kind of scenario we're in, the context we're in, and the recession, where vast amounts of public money are now being put into the private sector to hold it up, there should be some return in terms of offering opportunities for designers and other professionals to work with the public realm to add value and transform it in the kind of ways that we're talking about.
Seems slightly nervous as such a universal audience. I chair a resident association in the University of Glasgow, and I was reflecting on the impact of the community spirit, two situations, one which was a success and another which is a failure, and I seek your advice on all of this. Success being preventing the nightclub in the Botanic Gardens in a public space, which took very strong community action to civil authority. The really no engagement took place, the very much a quite aggressive campaign, the community was successful. The thing that I have is in the, I know you can't help comment on particular situations, is the new BBC development down in the River Club in the West End of Glasgow, in which I sought the support of the Lighthouse, which I received on the BBC last year. But I have to say that some other voices say to me, why do you think this is the authority would listen to us in the context of what we consider to be at best an upmarket FE construction and a very important part of the West End of Glasgow? How do we influence the private developer?
Gosh. I think influencing the private sector is a major, major concern. I think market forces will ultimately will be a major influence on them, and of course the people who are central to that are consumers, and if you have strong informed consumers who know how to advocate for good design, who know how to advocate for a quality environment and equality in the environment, then ultimately that will impact on the market, and the market will eventually impinge on the thoughts of private developers. But that's not really an answer. The answer is I don't really know. I think it's very, very difficult. And certainly in Aberdeen, I live in the West End of Glasgow, work in Aberdeen. In Aberdeen, I wouldn't mention the house volume house builder's name, but you can see the stuff everywhere in Aberdeen. You think, my God, how can that possibly happen? Which seems to cut across planning, the desires of local residents associations and everything. But I keep going back to my central thing. It's all about, as a society and as a community, we are not skilled up enough and informed enough and able enough to talk about and engage on these issues at scale in a way that will be influential on politics and politicians, if you like. In a way that seems to be effective and obviously happening in smaller other European countries. So I think it is achievable, but we have some way to go, as I keep saying.
Sorry, my name is Chris Sunak, and I'm here to external research associate with Grey School of Arts at the UCAS. But actually, the thing that struck me, particularly in light of what you just said about commercial developers, is that the situation has changed since I was working within a sort of the central art policy context up in the northeast of Scotland. And now you do see that the housing development bodies, the professional bodies, have awards for community engagement. And I think over the past 10 years, they themselves have begun to change. And I think actually active engagement with them on these issues is not completely pointless.
Probably from that to the council, not to defend our position, but we do try to get the communities involved, and there was a site that had been put on the market a few months ago for Christmas teaching the West End, and I was involved with the fighting on the bridge for the community consultation. So the public sector has definitely moving towards the community. And we have to take a lot of response, and we have to take the response of the public into our judgment of which team was going to be and be over the time. And now public, well, of course, now the economic climate has changed, so nothing is going to happen there. But we have tried. And we also try along the canal, and the architect for the White House Bar, which is a small development that is going to happen along the canal. And I have to say, I think the community is involved all the time, along the way. We have followed many of the points that we have included in the talk, and I hope that the company will be able to complain about it. It should come to me.
I have to say, and I'm not a spokesperson for Glasgow City Council, but this city, more than any other probably in the United Kingdom, has done more in terms of trying to engage people in the debate about planning and developing their own environment than many others. There's still a long way to go, and lots more could be done, but I think it does have a track record in that kind of public listening, if you like, or making the attempt to engage with the public.
Thank you. I'm going to stay here because it seems I'm making all the noises happening because... Yep, thank you so much, Stuart, for a brilliant lecture, and thank you to everybody for your contributions. I think there's obviously a lot more to talk about, so if you're able to stay and carry on the conversation, there are some drinks available, and I believe some campaigns as well. So please stay to carry on talking. We'll close this part. Yeah, so please join me in thanking Stuart for having us here.
Thank you. Thank you.